Hi, I'm Edward Cohen. Welcome to Tangent.
Hey there, I'm Jeffrey Berman. It's great to be here again.
Today we're joined by Zach Ahrens. Welcome back, Zach.
Thanks for having me again. Great to be here.
Well, hold on a second. Zach is a listed cast member. So we should actually, I know we want to introduce our guest, but I want everybody to hear this. Zach, we miss you when you're gone. So gosh darn it, never stop not being here. Okay? Never stopping.
I will make sure to be on every Tangent broadcast until my larynx has been physically removed from my body.
You heard it here first, folks.
He's live. He's on the record. Today on Tangent, we have a special guest, Robert McDonald, managing partner at Cherry Lawn Capital, a new founder-friendly credit product designed to help PropTech companies and real estate-related tech businesses build real estate portfolios. Hi, Robbie. Where does this podcast find you?
I'm calling in from Naples, Florida. Thank you so much for having me. And Zach and Jeff, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
Today, we're going to talk about some interesting topics that are dear to our hearts and to the work that we all do and that we've all been doing here. We're going to talk about the state of PropTech. How did we get here, where we are now, and where we're going? But let's set the stage, right? So by the end of 2023, venture funding for PropTech was coming from major highs. However, it had dropped by 42% year over year to just over $11 billion in VC funding, down from almost $20 billion in 2022 and $32 billion in 2021. So Robbie and Jeff and Zach, how did we get here?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to go first. I think, you know, from my perspective, coming from the real estate world, which I can get to in a bit, I feel like a bunch of, you know, capital has chased venture capital more broadly speaking. Real estate has been traditionally a, somewhat archaic space. That's in need of certainly technology-driven transformation. And folks like Zach and Jeff, early realizers of that opportunity and have, capitalized on that in a lot of ways. And, I think this, pressure from capital has come down from the top, meaning asset allocators chasing yields, at the institutional capital level over the last few years. But, the need is still there. And I think there's a lot of room to grow. So,
I mean, a lot of people saying that, these valuations that we're getting in previous years were nature of a ZIRP, of a zero interest rate phenomena. Meanwhile, now we have founders that are caught chasing those high valuations or perhaps inherited unrealistic growth trajectories that now with a higher interest rate environment are no longer feasible. So curious to hear what, how are you guys advising your companies and how are you navigating this environment?
So let me take a stab at both questions at the same time. The answer to the first one is there is too much money in the system, period. Everybody thought, no matter where they were operating from, whether they were the professional venture capitalists or corporates or angels, that they could be VCs. Like, oh yeah, I could play this game too, without really having a solid understanding of venture mechanics, which is actually a thing, finance, which is actually a thing, and growth trajectories in an environment that hasn't traditionally had technology applied to it. I will respectfully disagree with Robert. I do not think real estate is a dinosaur industry. I think there are quite a number of sophisticated operators, even all the way back to 2008 when Casey and I were concepting out Canberra Creek. The difference is, or the nuance rather, is that just because you can add technology to something doesn't mean it actually adds value. It's the Rube Goldberg problem. And if you're making money, then something has to be an order of magnitude better than what you're already doing in order to adopt it. And we have a handful of portfolio companies that are fairly old, started a long time ago when our LPs, who are large strategic owners and operators of real estate, looked at it and said, this is cool, but not going to really add a ton of value. And then years later, they said, when we're looking for cutting costs or adding to anything that could be accretive to the bottom line, then it became, okay, we're gonna use this. So I wouldn't necessarily agree that it's the industry that is at fault. I would say it's capital, and then the rush of capital that went in And especially at the apex, where there were billions and billions and billions of dollars funding companies that we would look at and say, none of these have a shot at a venture return. And so you have a massive cohort of companies that are inevitably going to fail. And that's okay. Like, that's part of our industry. But this idea that there was space for everybody to operate and finance these companies, thankfully, has passed. Zach, I'm very curious what you think.
Yeah, I think there was a massive misallocation of venture dollars into businesses that are not necessarily bad businesses if funded properly, but they're not the types of businesses that the venture capital model is conducive to funding. The way the venture capital model plays out typically is power law driven, and the companies that tend to drive the power laws, and the power laws are what drive the returns to the limited partners in venture funds, those tend to be very scalable, high gross margin software and hardware companies. If you look historically, some of the largest companies currently operating on planet Earth were created with the venture capital model, and a lot of them have very, very high gross margins. Microsoft is a great example. Apple, while it's a hardware and a software business, has very strong gross margins, a lot of scalability. That was venture-backed. Google, they delve into a bunch of low gross margin experimentation, but their core business is a very high margin, very scalable, very repeatable business, right? That was also venture-backed, created with this model. So I think what you had, and I don't know the correct annual amount, right? Is it 10 billion? Should it be 20 billion? Should it be 50 billion? We always would comp historically to our close cousin in fintech. And if you look at fintech, it peaked still much higher than PropTech ever peaked at. And if you look at financial services and its contribution to GDP, you look at real estate and its contribution to GDP, one can argue that real estate technology is still underfunded. I think the challenge with what we do is always you can never get something or almost never get something, because it's the built environment, that has a 95% gross margin profile inherent in its business model. We've gotten comfortable with that over the years. We think you can still drive venture scale returns investing in businesses that have 60 to 70% gross margins, as long as the TAMs are big and the teams are big and the products are big. And to Jeff's point, the technology isn't built for its own sake. It's actually driving efficiency, automation, et cetera, across the organization. What we saw at the peak times were a lot of companies that were either real estate service businesses that where the margin expansion of the technology was unclear, or they were really just real estate arbitrage businesses. And I don't want to come out here and say those businesses should never be funded again, or they're all bad businesses, but they should not be funded by power law driven venture funds who are hungry for that breakneck growth. I think what our category really needs is some sort of earlier stage PE or more patient capital, maybe high teens IRR instead of, you know, low 30s IRR driven type returns in order to fund the next cycle of those businesses. Because I want to still see those businesses created. But I think what the last cycle taught us was and if you see it in the public markets, you know, like what is held up from a multiple perspective in the public equity markets are these businesses that are data businesses, that are SaaS businesses, they're enterprise resource planning management tools, right? They're tough to rip out software stuff. And a lot of the real estate-y kind of stuff has either washed out completely or it's seen its trading multiple massively compressed to the point where investors are not seeing the returns they need.
Thank you for that. Some of these businesses, I think they had the commonality that both the commonality and also the the uniqueness about real estate technology, which is you are creating a solution, a tech solution, or a fintech solution that involves real estate, real assets. That means that you'll have to go and either partner, sell to the owners and operators of real estate assets, or as many companies have opted in the last few years, go and raise a separate vehicle to go and actually acquire these assets. And that's where we've seen a lot of the misalignments, if you will, both in the capital, but also in the incentives for the founders of these tech companies themselves. Robbie, can you speak more to that and how, you know, some of the pros and cons of these propco, opco structures that became very popular in the past 5-10 years and now are seeing that they may need to either transition or that may need to take new decisions based on their, you know, for a new structure that is more sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said, you know, on that, especially Zach's points. You know, I think inherently the opco-propco structure, I mean, I think if you take a step back and look at, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago, folks putting stuff on their balance sheet, right, using almost entirely VC money, right, to either acquire properties or kickstart some sort of marketplace or whatever it might be, taking on real asset exposure, right, notably with VC equity, then moving in towards this sort of opco-propco structure, which, you know, is a step in the right direction, but still has these sort of inherent capital and incentive misalignments, right, where there's sort of VC money either in the, you know, putting up the GP commitment on either the deal level or some vehicle level, and then the incentive misalignment, right? And so, you know, it naturally, it's, you know, you can adopt in that structure sort of the normal promote, right, using real estate terms, structure and incentive structure to motivate a GP. But, you know, when founders have their eyes on, you know, $1 billion valuation, and that's how they make their money, the incentive structure kind of goes out the door, right? So there's sort of these inherent incentive misalignments. And then there's this sort of mix of capital where VC money is being put up into a GP position, which is a great position to be in. It's just not the same return profile and risk profile as VC.
Yeah, no, and we've seen some examples of this, you know, including companies like Placemaker, the short and long-term rental platform whose CEO and co-founder Jason Feudin was on Tangent, and Industrious, which we covered just in our previous episode with their former head of real estate, Kat Lau. I mean, these are prime examples that started as venture-backed businesses that have now transitioned to being solid, you know, sustainable real estate brands, real estate businesses.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to add on one thing there, I mean, it's, you know, it's like, it's really, okay, most of the time it's to take on real asset exposure to kickstart some sort of marketplace. I think we saw that when Title Free passed in 2012, you know, everyone sort of rushed into the crowdfunding space, right, and said, okay, well, it's easy enough to build a tech solution for this marketplace, and we can now sell these equity slugs and debt slugs to doctors and lawyers, right? We can build a tech experience around that and make it super efficient. Makes total sense. But it's a chicken or the egg problem, right? So you go to the sponsors and say, okay, we have a, you know, a more efficient equity piece for you. They say, great, like, show me the money, right? And you go to the doctors and lawyers, and you say, okay, we have great deals. And they're great, show me the deals. And so being, you know, pressured somewhat by VC and also, you know, other sort of pressures, it's okay, well, let's take on the first deal and then we'll sort of build out of that quickly. But it's a slippery slope. And what ends up happening, as we've seen over the last decade, is a lot of these marketplaces end up becoming real estate businesses, right? Not just sort of one example, but.
Which is perfectly fine. I mean, venture at the end of the day is the longest game in the alternative asset class, right? So you got to be in the long run to really generate those insane returns, and but also not insane, like to generate, you know, the generational change that technology has typically brought to, you know, across the board, not only to real estate. In the heart of Silicon Valley, there's an organization making waves in helping solve the housing crisis, Housing Trust Silicon Valley. At Housing Trust, they provide developer financing, homeownership assistance, and lender and broker resources to help create more equitable and affordable communities. Established over 20 years ago by local businesses, community leaders, and affordable housing activists, Housing Trust Silicon Valley uses transformative housing finance and public and private partnerships to create a strong, affordable housing market. from those experiencing homelessness to developers, renters, and first-time home buyers, Housing Trust SV is dedicated to ensuring that every neighbor has access to safe, stable, and affordable housing. Housing Trust SV is making a difference in the 14 counties of the Greater Bay Area and Sacramento. These are communities with a common need: more affordable housing and the capital to support its development. Join the Housing Trust SV in making a lasting impact on our communities. Housing Trust Silicon Valley, where innovation meets compassion. Learn more at housingtrustsv.org. Now let's talk about Cherry Lawn Capital, Robert, and your background, because I mean, you know, you have experienced so much of this progress and unraveling firsthand, you know, with your real estate and also PropTech background. So yeah, curious to hear for Tangent listeners, you know, what's your professional background that prepared you to now help also, you know, PropTech companies in this moment in time?
Sure. Yeah. So just can go over the, you know, quick background on me. So started kind of cut my teeth in Brooklyn selling mixed use stuff for a group called Terra CRG, which is now a fairly prominent brokerage in Brooklyn, selling mostly mixed use stuff and you know, Bushwick and Bed-Stuy in the early 2010s. Then went down to DC to do more institutional level sales. So selling office portfolios sort of up and down the Dulles Quarter and around the DC area. A lot of 70s and 80s vintage stuff that we had to kind of get creative on that was, you know, a little bit, you know, too hairy for value-added investors. Sometimes we split off parcels and sold them to home builders, that sort of thing. Came back up to New York to do private placements. So for a group that actually focuses on real assets more broadly, so not just real estate, but timber, got to look at some ag funds, got to look at a water fund, which is super interesting. And so really started to, you know, understand sort of how these things are structured, you know, mostly closed end funds, but also co-investment programs, some interesting sort of structured JV accounts, you know, across all sort of real assets from institutional capital. And then went to the principal side of the business in a very sort of data and analytic heavy way for a company called Amherst, which, Jeff, to your point, you know, Amherst has been data driven, tech driven for 30 plus years, right? They've built an entire business around being tech or data driven. I think they have the largest set of proprietary mortgage data in the country, you know, and that's how they facilitate most of their trades. And so this is sort of in the early days of SFR. At the time, they were only sort of buying off the MLS. They built the fantastic AVM sort of proprietary trading software to do that. You know, and I sort of met with them and said, you should be rolling out mom and pop portfolios, which they've been thinking about. So sort of built a desk out to do that. And then went to the startup side of the world at a VC-backed company called Intera, which effectively provides that sort of same service, data-driven acquisitions from a third-party perspective to groups, you know, like Invitation Homes, these large groups that at the time didn't really have this sort of infrastructure built out in-house. And then fell into the venture world, moved out to Boston, worked for a real estate tech-focused venture studio called Gemini, which has recently been rebranded as Stackpoint Ventures, led by two very, you know, successful folks, Adam Pace and Chris Kelly. And, you know, got to see sort of firsthand how the sausage was made, if you will. So was, you know, sort of like the in-house real estate person there, led a lot of our diligence. And what I found was, you know, in speaking with a lot of these founders was, you know, how are you going to take on real asset exposure was the question that I basically was asking on every call. And so, you know, just to sum that up, you know, I'd always sort of been a prop tech junkie. I'd called, you know, both Jeff and Zach. I remember going to Metaprop panel, must have been like 2017 or something like that. And I'd always been a fan of the space. Yeah, I mean, you know, so we're circling around this opportunity of like, how do you solve this opco-propco problem? How do you sort of create a means for both companies that are in a position where they maybe should transition out of venture capital, right? Or, you know, on the earlier side, have an alternative to venture capital. And so sort of created a credit product, excuse me, to cater to those pain points that I observed. That's sort of the origin of Cherry Lawn.
Interesting. Yeah, something that really caught my eye about Cherry Lawn since I met Robbie was how he views the space and, you know, in terms of helping companies, like Robbie said, either transition from a VC-backed like tech multiple valuation to a data-driven or tech-enabled real estate company, or set them up for a successful future venture round at a more favorable valuation, right? Once they have proven their concept, once they have tested their solution in real buildings with real people. But let's talk about more about the solution and, you know, how is Cherry Lawn becoming an additional capital partner for founders?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the time, and again, we're not talking about every single real estate tech company here. We're really talking about a subset of that group that I believe is, you know, either a tech or data driven real estate business at heart. So these companies oftentimes are taking on real asset exposure to either, you know, prove out product market fit, sort of get momentum before they can transition out, much like sort of the marketplace problem that I mentioned earlier, or drive revenues, right? So you can think about the originators in the HA space or others that, you know, drive fees from originating assets. You know, we believe that this credit product basically allows somebody to maintain, you know, the potential for raising a successful next venture round, but also provides a safety net. And so an easier transition into becoming what could be a real estate fund management business or another type of business model. And so really what we found is there's not just pains for the founders, but there's also pains for the capital providers, right? And what should be traditionally a fairly easy deal for, say, a bank to participate in becomes difficult because of the managerial risk associated with the, you know, what is effectively a first-time manager of these assets or originator being a tech business, that coupled with sort of this broader dislocation in venture capital markets, you know, and the general fear of, are you going to be even around long enough to originate these assets and utilize the credit facility? So, you know, a good example of this might be an HEA business, just sticking with that sort of context. So that business is effectively a storefront business model. Banks are not really willing to step in and provide what should be a pretty easy credit facility, simple meaning, you know, the securitization market's picked up in that space, right? And so because of those reasons, and so we would step in and basically provide a mezzanine position on that credit facility so the bank's comfortable. And we couple that with sort of an operational reserve that allows the founder to draw down from to either extend a runway to the next venture round or have more cash on hand so they don't have to raise as much equity in that venture round. If we're dealing with a situation that doesn't have a securitization market, we can use that pool to effectively seed fund one, right? So we're partnered with folks that put up GP capital for that fund. We can provide sort of back-end GP services, fund admin, et cetera, and then are very friendly with the placement agents that, you know, can raise that capital for them. So we view it as sort of a win-win for both capital and founders, and just sort of fixing the problem for both. But absolutely curious what you know, Zach and Jess' opinion on this is from a different perspective.
So Robert, and maybe I missed this because of the sounds that are going on behind me, but what is the difference between this and traditional venture debt?
So I would say this is, so in the case of an HEA business, right, we're actually backing.
Just to clarify, HEI, home equity investment.
That's correct, right?
Yeah.
So a company that, you know, or originates like, just using that sort of as a context. So our debt is backed by real estate, right? So either equity sort of rights to real estate, existing pools that they have. It can be contractual fee streams tied to those real assets, such as servicing rights in the case of HEAs, property management fees, et cetera. And then, you know, in the case where there's an origination facility, you know, pledging effectively the B piece in that securitization and servicing rights cash flows on that securitized pool. So our debt, notable difference is this debt is not backed by potential preferred equity, right? It, in the operating business, it's backed by both the equity upside in or equivalent in the real assets, and then also contractual fee streams tied to the real
assets. So this is mostly for prop codes. This is not, this wouldn't be for a traditional software business.
That's correct.
I see. Okay. And okay. So essentially what you're trying to do is add the flexibility of venture debt for real estate. So, like a hard money loan, right?
Yeah, similar. I mean, in some ways we're less expensive than, you know, in terms of cost of capital than traditional venture debt. You know, we're shooting for high teens sort of, you know, total return in terms of a gross IRR perspective. But, you know, we just see that, you know, we kind of view these companies as first time investment management businesses, right? And so they need some sort of the equivalent of seed capital, and so they're in this tight situation. And so we sort of couple this with.
Can you, sorry to interrupt. Can you give me a real world example where you've done this? You don't necessarily have to name the company. In fact, don't. but except I'm having a hard time understanding when, how this works, and this also happens to you because I'm not as intelligent as Zach. And I'm not even just saying that. It's actually true. He's pretty smart. I'm just under, but he's very bright.
Yeah, no problem. So maybe another example would be, another context might be helpful. Looking at perhaps a company that is a tech-enabled property manager of short-term rentals. And to be very clear to answer your question, Jeff, we sort of formally, we're very early on, right? We're a startup in ourselves. So we're 5 weeks in the market. We've been talking with a bunch of different groups, have a solid pipeline built up, and we're sort of in the middle of executing on that pipeline. We wind up sort of a great capital partner relationship and facilitating those deals now. So luckily we've got a lot of deal flow and the product seems to be resonating with the market. Another example might be, a company that goes out and is rolling out property management companies in the short-term rental space, for example, right? And so they need dollars to go buy mom and pop property management businesses, right? They have an existing pool of, assets that produce property management revenue. And they need acquisition capital to go buy these businesses. And they can back that by the existing portfolio of property management revenue, and then also the expanded portfolio.
Okay, right? So in other words, yeah. you're taking the capital is revenue based financing.
Yeah, and so in some cases, okay. Yes.
Okay, so what I'm asking is there anything specifically different about the product or the process that makes this novel, or is yours just another entrant into the private credit space, which by the way is great because credit's necessary. I'm just trying to understand what the mode is.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think where we're slightly different is that we, most folks in this space don't have, haven't originated or don't have an existing pool of assets or contractual fee streams that's large enough to back, a loan or would make it sort of prohibitively expensive. And so for that reason, we can actually take on a, sometimes we'll slip in effectively a convertible note, which looks a lot more like traditional sort of, some forms of debt that are out in the market today. But that can be traded out of over time. So in the case of like an HEA business that is going to originate a pool that can be securitized, right? Once that pool exists, there's a much larger set of ways to pay us back simply, right? And so they can trade out of that convertible note and then exchange it effectively for dollars in that newly securitized pool. And then additionally, we kind of bolt on this operational reserve, which makes sort of founders a little bit more comfortable in terms of, de-risking the timing and amount of their next venture raise. But, on top of that, I think both my and my partner, Kyle Shank, who I worked with at the studio, who's a phenomenal engineer, can both sort of add value to these companies in a sort of a more creative way from a strategic perspective or a data perspective or tech perspective, having both been in the trenches before and, we're finding ourselves having conversations around, hey, can we have a separate dialogue around data products, right? Or can we have a separate dialogue around outsourcing tech, given where we are in our company maturation, that sort of thing. So we're not, like drastically different than anything that's out there. It's just kind of packaged together in a different way.
Okay.
What I'm gathering is the optionality here for founders, Robbie, correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of setting these companies up for future success in raising a venture round once they've proven their concept or once they can really get to growth stage, they will have the option to select how they can pay back the debt. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, effectively, it comes down to the discount rate on those net present value of those cash flows. They draw down a dollar from that operational reserve. They can trade it for a dollar in terms of, the net present value of the servicing fees if we're using the home equity investments example or the B piece of that securitization. And so we think that it provides some sort of option value to the founders as well, which makes them a little bit more comfortable and feel a little bit more agile.
Interesting. And in the current market, I mean, leaving aside prop tech focused companies, but there's a ton of tech companies out there that own real estate, right? So in the current market, I mean, there aren't too many aligned paths, if you will, today for operators to free up the equity while maintaining control of the operations of their assets.
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, we're also coming across a lot of like single asset deals, if you want to think about it that way, where, you know, most of them fall into like development risk, which we're not trying to really take on at this point. But groups that are, you know, doing, for example, modular construction or whatever it might be, and they're doing deal by deal raises on the real estate, and they're putting sort of venture dollars into that GP position, when in my view, at least, they should have, you know, co-GP dollars in that position. And the problem exists also outside of real estate too, which is interesting. If you look at, it's really anything to do with real assets. So yeah, I think vertical farming might be a good example. You know, companies that it makes sense to me, at least, you know, from a tech perspective, of saying, going to a farmer and saying, hey, you can create, you know, 3x the amount of crop yield by having a, you know, this effectively a greenhouse, right? And then I can sort of, you know, line you up with somebody to construct that greenhouse. I can line you up with financing, and I'll give you a software to basically manage that, right? That sort of makes sense. But you have to be able to prove that you can produce 3x the amount of crops, right? So oftentimes, and we've seen this like App Harvest, you know, Bowery Farms having some issues that are related, but these companies are, you know, go out and end up buying farms, right? And App Harvest had to basically skirt bankruptcy, ended up selling their farmland in South America for like 70 cents of a dollar, I believe, something like that. And so these opportunities, I think, exist, and the same problems exist across all real assets, I guess, is my point there.
Interesting. The great transition. Let's talk about some of the potential outcomes for these PropTech companies that also own real estate, or that are hoping to own real estate. Curious to hear what, you know, what you guys are seeing on the VC side. But the way I see it is there's a few outcomes for these companies. Like, they either transition from being VC backed with a tech multiple valuation to becoming a data driven or a tech enabled real estate company. They can also be set up for a successful future venture round once they've proven their model, or they may default. So what companies you think are more, or what, you know, subsectors within PropTech are more ripe for each bucket?
I can take that one. I mean, I think any company, if you're on the venture track, you can stay on that track until you stop growing in a venture-like manner, and then you have to push to get profitable and or get financing an alternative way, right? And maybe at that point, this financial instrument from Cherry Lawn is a good option. I think companies run into significant issues when they've raised too much money at too high valuations and then decide to do that. So there are certain categories where, just speaking raw numbers, there have never been private equity or strategic exits of those types of real estate service companies at greater than, call it, $500 million. So if you were a tech-enabled service company and you raise money at a $200 million valuation while you were growing 3x year over year, but then you wake up 3 years later and you're EBITDA profitable, but maybe you're only growing 30% year over year, theoretically, you can still sort of grow into a profitable, won't be a home run, but a profitable exit for your previous investors, yourself, to a private equity sponsor, or to a larger strategic, right? One of the publicly traded real estate service companies, most likely, right? I think a lot of companies in the last cycle, they ran into the unfortunate problem where they raised, call it, 50, 60, 70, 80 million at post-money valuations of 3, 4, 5, 6, 700 million and beyond. And when you peel back, when the froth settles and you sort of peel back the onion and you look at what's actually out there in terms of tangible, meaningful acquirers for those businesses, they're not out there at those numbers. So I think how we now counsel our more servicey type businesses, our sort of, say, lower gross margin businesses, we don't want to stop investing in them, but we want them to be gut checking at every round. How fast are you growing? At what margin profile are you experiencing that growth? Because as we know from 21, anyone can grow 3 to 4x if you're burning enough money to do so, right? Or selling $2 bills for $1. So once you get that gut check, right, we as VCs will re-underwrite the investor round for the next time, and we'll look at what the historical exits have been, and then we'll advise you on what your path should be. And most people, when they decide to get off that venture treadmill or hamster wheel, they can't necessarily become EBITDA profitable immediately. And so that's where a credit product might become fruitful for them, I think, potentially. But we are seeing a company that's perfectly run, and it's really hard to do this, has at their disposal the ability to dial up and back certain levers and push for growth or push for EBITDA margin expansion, fundamentally.
We don't like pointing fingers here, and there's no one culprit, but some may call it, instead of a hamster wheel, the previous cycle, a tiger wheel. But that's a different story. Anyway, Robbie, collaboration superpower. If you had to choose one person, historic or living, to do a partnership with, who would it be?
It's a good question. Very much appreciate it. It's kind of a cheesy answer, but certainly an honest one. So aside from inventing what I would consider to be like modern portfolio allocation theory, not that I'm an expert in that by any means, just a hobbyist, I guess. David Swensen. David Swensen, who was the CIO at Yale Endowment for, I think, 1985 until he passed away in 2021, I believe. Also the author of a fantastic book, Pioneering Portfolio Management, which I highly recommend. David Swensen backed early stage alternative investment management businesses. And he did this knowing he would be able to achieve better terms, provide strategic guidance, and ultimately grow with them. At its core, I think that's what Cherry Lawn aims to do. And I think, this mentality resonates certainly with VCs. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, I take a lot of sort of, practices and philosophies from sort of first-time fund management investment businesses and try to apply them here. That would be my answer, David Swensen.
David Swensen, rest in peace. Sounds like he was a massive legend and left us with a lot of insights. Zach, who is your collaboration superpower this week?
I'm going to have to go with Paul Annacone. Brad Gilbert gets all the press. He's written all the books. Paul Annacone, I don't believe he's written a single book. Was not the greatest tour player of all time, but arguably, quietly, the greatest tennis coach of all time. For those of you who have not followed Paul Annacone's career, he's coached greats, most currently coaching Taylor Fritz, but prior to that, coached folks like Roger Federer, most famously coached Pete Sampras for the bulk of his career, many others that I'm not mentioning. This year for Tangent, I'm going to have collaboration superpower be a tennis coach every single time.
Wow.
So get ready.
Wait, Zach, do you play tennis?
I become obsessed with tennis, and Paul Annacone is my coach du jour, my gold chef. Okay. As we all know, the job of venture capitalist and tennis coach very closely correlated. I believe, while I could, since I'm only the second best prop tech VC to you, I could be the second best or maybe the third or fourth best tennis coach.
Let me tell you something. I never said the best. In fact, in my phone, when Zach rings, it actually says Zach Aaron's Angel Genius.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, because I mean, we just had
a special ring.
We just had a nice one, right? A nice little something,
I don't count. I don't count money until it's in my bank account, Jeffrey. I suggest you do the same.
Wait, what? I've already spent it.
A good VC, like a responsible VC. No, this podcast is now Tangent and Tennis officially. And Paul Annacone is a name that I have heard in the past. I was familiar with Roger Federer, this Swiss fella, but I also thought he stopped having a coach a few years back. And it was his wife who was allegedly coaching him.
He's worked with about five or six coaches over his career and has been self-coached at times as well. You are correct. But he had a very good run with Mr. Anacone.
Massive, massive. Well, there you go. Robbie, where can Tangent listeners connect with you and learn more about Cherry Lawn Capital?
Sure. So we do have a website, cherrylawncapital.com, or there, you know, feel free to email me directly, rmcdonaldmcdonald@cherrylawncapital.com.
Wonderful. Robbie McDonald, managing partner at Cherry Lawn Capital. Thank you so much for coming to Tangent today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you both, Jeff and Zach.
You got it.
Have a good one, guys. Zach, see you on the court.
Thank you. I got some great sweatbands that just came in the mail. I'm ready for you, Edward. You just got to come to my club anytime.
I'm coming.
After your Pilates prep.
I'm coming. It's happening. Tangent on the court next time.
If you like what you heard, please subscribe, rate, and review Tangent and share the show with a friend. This episode is produced by me, Edward Cohen. Thanks for listening to Tangent, and remember, collaboration is our superpower. So stay curious and always be learning.